Army Captain Louise Montalvan came back from Iraq suffering from wounds that included post-traumatic stress disorder. Just getting through the day was a fight he didn't always win, until he was paired with a service dog named Tuesday. Montalvan tells how he found healing in his bond with a golden retriever in his best-selling book, Until Tuesday. And he'll tell us more about it today on Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Also today, we'll hear the first segment in a documentary series featuring the voices of Central Illinois veterans, produced by students at Urbana's Unilab High School. And I'll talk with two of the people who worked on the series. That's coming up on Focus. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Just a note, about 40 past the hour, we will talk with WILL's Dave Dickey and former Uni High School student Sanjay Koshi about their work on the new Uni High student documentary featuring the voices of veterans. We'll be running segments of the documentary all this week during Focus. But first, we'll talk to retired Army Captain Luis Carlo Montalvan. He wrote a best-selling book with a bright-eyed golden retriever on the cover. The dog is named Tuesday, and he is Montalvan's service dog. Tuesday helps in physical ways, fetching things, steadying his balance, but the emotional bond the two share may be even more important for Montalvan, who came back from a tour of duty in Iraq with severe post-traumatic stress disorder. Montalvan wrote his book about that bond, named Until Tuesday, with collaborator Brett Witter in 2011. The book has become a bestseller. It's in development for a movie. And Montalvan now does a lot of public speaking about post-traumatic stress disorder. He'll be speaking at Parkland College in Champaign on November 15th as part of a program on PTSD. And he's my guest today on Focus. Captain Montalvan, welcome to Focus.
Oh, thanks for having us, Jim. We're looking forward to chatting with you.
You said us. I'm wondering, is Tuesday with you right now?
Absolutely.
Okay. I think this is, our conversation is going to be a great degree about post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And I think it's hard for other people to really get a handle on what people with PTSD are going through. Can you tell us how the world seemed to you when your PTSD was at its worst?
Sure. Just as a footnote to start, post-traumatic stress disorder doesn't necessarily come on all of a sudden. You know, that's one misconception. In fact, studies have shown that the average service member who comes back from war, and this is just to speak of PTSD as it relates to warriors, because obviously there are others, crime victims, survivors, and others who are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder. But for those who have been in combat, the average time that PTSD begins to rear its head is about 18 months. So it's not necessarily something that is brought on by one calamitous situation, but rather sustained, prolonged exposure to combat in the case of warriors. For me, it happened to be that way. After two tours in Iraq, but particularly after the first tour, we weren't talking about post-traumatic stress disorder, the U.S. military, in 2003-2004. And yet, after that tour, and even toward the end of that tour, I think most people were feeling some effects of war, whether it was sleeplessness or hypervigilance, and I was certainly among that group. Of course, you, as a warrior, most warriors, they want to do their job. They want to. They don't consider themselves broken or affected because we're so inculcated with being tough and resilient. And so you sort of deny symptoms that you have until over time the symptoms become worse And, you know, for me, when I was in the very throes of PTSD, which I don't know, I mean, again, began toward the end of my tour in 2004 and really was at its worst in 2007 and 2008, because I hadn't gotten any treatment. I experienced, I think, what is perhaps the worst symptom of post-traumatic stress disorder, and that is what's called agoraphobia. And that's essentially a fear of being out in public, of being outside, and being out in certain in many situations, which, as you can imagine, essentially cuts off a person from living, you know, from engaging in the world, from engaging in relationships, and that I think is quite crippling because it creates the mindset of hopelessness. You know, if I can't even go outside, if I can't even, you know, do this, well, then that can create the sort of state of depression and sadness that then can lead to substance abuse and worse.
Before we go on, I want to invite our listeners, if you're a veteran or someone who suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder, or if you know someone close to you who is, we'd love to hear from you this hour on Focus. Call in at 1-800-222-9455. That's toll-free, 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Captain Montalvan, in your book, you called PTSD a dwelling disease, and I wonder if you could talk about what that means.
Yeah, and by the way, thanks, Jim, for putting out that sort of clarion call, inviting veterans with disabilities with PTSD to share their thoughts, because that is, it's more important than people think. I mean, discussing these matters is you know, goes to the very heart of the healing process. So thanks for that.
Sure thing.
Indeed, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder is a dwelling disease. And I know people, there are plenty of people who hasten to call it a disease or a disorder, and there's some assertions on many sides as to what to call post-traumatic stress. But it is for sure a state, a condition where your body and your mind can stay in a prolonged state of sadness or depression or stress or hypervigilance, and that makes it a particularly difficult psychological disorder, you know, to use the clinical term. It's hard to move on from, you know, let's say Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's five stages of grief. You know, it's hard to move on from, let's say, a state of anger, or a state of sadness, the way people without PTSD tend to do. It takes longer, and it affects a person's it affects a person's disposition. It affects a person's day. It affects their relationships greater than someone without post-traumatic stress disorder who, you know, gradually sort of these emotions pass. But dwelling on things for such a long period of time really not only has a degrading effect, a further degrading effect on a person's psychological makeup, emotional makeup, but it also affects their body. You know, they they get high blood pressure, they get sick, they don't eat well. These types of things can happen, and it, you know, we've received, Tuesday and I, we've received so many letters from people saying thank you for articulating it in that fashion, which you just mentioned, that it is a dwelling. Now it makes sense to me, because I didn't understand it to be this dwelling thing. And I think that when a person sort of owns their condition and learns about their condition, they can better ameliorate it.
And so as a dwelling disease, maybe that becomes the challenge, is essentially getting off to square where you're at and being able to get into another state. That becomes maybe the big challenge to overcome.
Precisely.
We have a caller on line one, Doug from Thomasboro. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, good morning. I'm one of the individuals that's affected by this. I'd like to propose something to think about, and this is what I've learned with my own care and treatment, trying to get through and helping others. PTSD is a function of three things, I would suggest. Number one, where we go from tranquility to sheer terror back and forth nanoseconds, so you're never stable. Again, the horrors of war, number one. Number two, the incredible neurophysiological effects of all the complex toxic exposures that affects brain functioning. We're seeing all of that with all of the pesticides and the hazmat, the burn pits, the DEU and everything else. And then the third part, which is probably the hardest one to get through with the PTSD, is the incredible crisis, ethical, moral crisis that we're facing from the things that we were involved in and what we did. And then coming back to face that, well, maybe there was no justification for that. And I'd like to have your guest comments on, you know, those three phases.
That's fascinating. Thanks for your comments, Doug, and for your service. I'm presuming that you serve, so thank you. I would say, I mean, I want to start off with your third point, because I think that is so often not spoken of, and that is the moral injuries, the moral choices, the impossible choices, decisions, life and death decisions that, in the case of warriors, they have to make on a rather frequent basis, and choices that can leave. You know, innocents exposed, hurt, killed, choices, decisions that save, certain people and soldiers and Americans and all kinds of moral and ethical decisions that are part of what makes war so horrible, And really, what causes, I think, a state of a psychologist, a Canadian psychologist, has posited, I think, a very interesting notion, and she calls it betrayal trauma. And this notion of betrayal being the flip side of trust, that when exposed to combat and those moral and ethical dilemmas and having to make these impossible no-win, so to speak, choices, life and death choices, then you come back home to the United States and you have to live with those decisions. And you have to wrench with these decisions for however many decades you live. That's part of the difficulty in what I refer to as the war after the war. With respect to DU and burn pits and other things, I mean, I think that's a component of, obviously that's physical, how did these atmospheric physical conditions affect the physical body, affect the brain, you mentioned neuropsychologically. I mean, I think that's a whole nother ball of wax, but I think it's interrelated and it's interesting. It'll be interesting to see how the medical field psychological field integrates the two, you know. And then his first point was, help me out, Jim.
The tranquility to terror, this sort
yes.
of quick flashing transition from one to another. And I think you wrote about, you know, not really having hallucinatory flashbacks, but mm-hmm. it was like all of a sudden you were getting the feeling of what it was like being back there.
Yes, yes, exactly. It's, I think, I mean, part of what I think Doug was talking about can be what's called panic attacks, which I didn't even know what that term was until after I got out of the service. And it's this, you know, all of a sudden your body reacts to stimulus, be it a scent, be it a noise or a situation, a group of people that all of a sudden starts to excite the heart, raise the blood pressure, and you feel, you know, like you're in that fight or flight mentality. Sometimes, as I wrote in the book, there's one particular incident that comes to mind vividly, and it's, you know, I had just gotten out of an intense therapy session with my therapist, who was amazing. She was a Marine herself and very empathetic and whatnot, and I walked to a coffee shop and I opened up my laptop, and staring me back in the face is this is the face of a sheared off suicide bomber, you know, the remnants, which I vividly recall after the event happened, you know, staring at me back, you know, and it wasn't a hallucination. It was a flashback. And then all of the feelings and as he mentioned, Doug mentioned, the terror of that situation affecting the present, which then caused me at the time to erupt into a migraine that caused me to flee back to my Brooklyn apartment. And on the way, I wrote about how funky I became, having sweated through my clothes, and then having to vomit, you know, out through one of the emergency doors on the subway, and just that the whole experience of going from a feeling of safety and sharing in my therapist's office to all of a sudden terror and you know, it's very disconcerting, particularly. I mean, it's disconcerting for anyone who has post-traumatic stress disorder. But for the warrior, I would posit that it's just a little bit more, because we're inculcated with being tough. You know, I mean, that was our job, to be tough.
Is that you're supposed to do something at that point and not just look
yeah.
for your own protection?
Yes, that to be, you know, it's this, you know, Greco-Roman mental wrestling match in your head with what is going on with my brain. I'm a hardened warrior. I've been in the military for 10 years. I've done this and that, and I'm tough. Why am I so incapacitated? You know, why can't I even leave my apartment? Why do I get a migraine just at the thought, just at the perception of a suicide bomber in the reflection of my laptop? You know, what have I become?
Well, this is Focus on WILL. We're talking now with retired Army Captain Luis Montalvan, and about his struggles with post-traumatic stress disorder and other injuries, but also what a service dog has meant for him in recovery. That's what Captain Montalvan, you've written about in the book Until Tuesday, and you'll be speaking at a program about PTSD November 15th at Parkland College in Champaign. I wanted to give out the phone number again and thank Doug for calling in with his comments.
Indeed.
Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. The email address, Will, WILL-talk@illinois.edu. You write a lot, of course, about just your close bond with Tuesday. And as a service dog, he is there to do very specific physical things, which helps you with, your injuries that have made it difficult to walk and keep balance and stuff. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the PTSD, can you tell us more about how Tuesday has been a help in that respect?
Certainly, Jim. And that's a really pivotal point to focus on. For me, I've had to strip down what PTSD, at my worst, looking slightly backward in time, when I was at my worst in terms of the symptoms, I've really done a lot of introspection, and my conclusion is that what PTSD does is that it wreaks havoc on a person's ability to trust. I mean, it destroys a person's ability to trust friends, to trust loved ones, to trust surroundings, to trust situations, sometimes to trust even the Almighty. I mean, some people lose their faith. To trust the VA, to trust the government, to trust, why does this happen? Well, in the case of warriors, and in the case of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans, as well as, I would say, Vietnam veterans, the enemy is invisible, largely. The enemy isn't wearing uniforms. And so, they weren't mostly wearing uniforms in the jungle, and they weren't wearing uniforms really in the Middle East. And so you are... your average warrior is in a constant state of vigilance, and I would argue, I would assert that the average service member is in a state of hypervigilance, which is a necessity in that environment, because you don't know really when a bomb may go off on the side of the road, nor do you know if Iraqi or Afghani security forces are going to shoot on you, nor do you know what civilian may do this or that. I mean, the enemy is all around you, and yet you don't know who or when it will come.
And once you're back home.
And so after 365 days of that, you're reprogrammed. I mean, Harvard says 21 days, right, to develop a habit. Well, after 365 days of patrols and this sort of environment, you're reprogrammed. And you can't actually, what scientists have said is that the brain has physiologically changed. The brain has been rewired after a tour like that.
So did Tuesday become part of the rewiring process in order to just be able to function on a regular daily level?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, sorry, I digressed a little bit about the trust issue, but because you see Tuesday where I could not trust in the VA, where I had mistrust in my surroundings, the very essence of how Tuesday helped me and helps me, though he knows all these tasks, as you mentioned, is that unlike any person, Tuesday not being a person, I can trust him no matter what. I can trust Tuesday no matter what to the end. You know, he's not going to be disloyal to me. He's not going to, his motivation is to help me as my service dog, and to be affectionate and to make me happy and to be happy. And that partnership has basically rebuilt a number of bridges back to the land of the trusting.
Now, this is something I was wondering. Of course, Tuesday is a trained service dog. He does many specific tasks for you. Mm-hmm. For someone who maybe didn't have your physical injuries but did suffer from PTSD, would you still need a dog with special training? Would a house pet make a difference?
I think many house pets, I know, well, I don't think, I know, because we've received tens of thousands of letters to that effect. Pets can certainly make a difference. That's not to say that every pet can make a difference, and that's not to say that every pet can necessarily make the same difference that, you know, a trained service dog can. But certainly, pets are a huge part of our emotional, psychological state of mind. They affect our state of mind in generally in a positive way. So they can certainly help, but I would say that a trained service dog, you know, is armed, so to speak, with that much more ability, tasks to help someone with either physical and or psychological disabilities.
Let me take a short break right now, and we'll be back with more conversation with Luis Montalvan, author of Until Tuesday. This is Focus on WILL. We're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking with retired Army Captain Luis Montalvan, author of the book Until Tuesday. He'll be the keynote speaker at Parkland College in Champaign, November 15th, for a program on PTSD. Want to take a quick call. We will be going to another interview in about 7 minutes, but right now let's talk to Dan from Sadorus. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yes, I want to say good morning, sir. Everything you're saying is right on the money, and I'm glad to hear you because it's like I'm sharing with somebody what I'm going through. And I've got three dogs, just pets, and they're my family. I've pretty much isolated myself, a hermit, and that's not what you're supposed to do, but I'm working on it. But I wanted to mention that I'm laid up. I'm 100%. I was on the other side of the house, sir. But
I got you.
I just wanted to mention that if they've got I don't have the number in front of me, but the National Suicide Hotline, they advertise for, and the VA's got the phone number. You can call that. It's an 800 number. You can call that 24 hours a day. And I think you press 1 to talk to veterans. And they're trained there. And if the first thing you say is, I'm not suicidal. I just need somebody to talk to. Hmm. And you can talk to them if you just need somebody to talk to for a little bit. You can do that in the middle of the night if you're having problems or whatever. And I lost a marriage over this. You know, I had a real bad blackout.
Yeah.
And ruined my marriage. And, you know, it is a lot. It's there. It's true. And, you know, and the trust issues and all that. You got everything right on the nail head.
Hey.
But I wanted to mention that hotline number if anybody needs it. I can't remember the number right now.
Well, I think I have it here. It's 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-TALK.
That's a...
Yeah. You press 1 for veterans. That's it.
Yeah, hey, Dan, that's a... First of all, thank you for your service, brother, from one veteran to another. And second of all, thanks for putting that out there. I think that's a terrific way, you know, not just to call if you're suicidal, but to call if you want to chat. I think that's a huge point, and thanks for bringing that up.
And Dan, thank you very much for calling in. You know, after hearing from someone like Dan and listening to you this morning, it's strange to consider also there are people who are suspicious of diagnosis of PTSD. You talk about your own struggles with your father.
Yeah.
In Until Tuesday, there are people who worry about essentially people trying to fake a diagnosis.
Yeah.
This even goes out to criticism that you've received. I saw the news article from a couple of years ago with people you had served with questioning the degree of your physical injuries. What do you say to that sort of doubting?
Well, you know, it's sadly Well, there's two things. First of all, sadly, warriors in particular, I mean, we live in a culture, and this is really cross-cultural. I mean, it extends globally. But we live in a culture where unless something is visibly seen, unless a condition, an injury, a wound is visibly seen, people question it. People question it. They doubt it. They don't understand the effects of it, many of them are extraordinarily insensitive to it, insensitive to the fact that in reality most disabilities are invisible. I mean, of the spectrum of disabilities, the large majority of them are invisible. You know, in the culture of the military, if you're broken, you know, we have a whole vernacular in the U.S. military for broken soldiers, warriors, and it's very condescending. I understand why it exists. It's because it's sort of a haze, you know, old school style of forcing people to get tougher. But unfortunately, there is such a thing as too much hazing, and there's such a thing as insensitivity, and not being able to get the help you need when you ask for help. I mean, we give professional athletes. We understand that to be a professional athlete is to sustain and recover from injuries, right? And to give them the best of care so they get off the bench and they get back in the game. But when you're in the military, that's not the case. Largely, you're made fun of, unless you are a catastrophic injury or wounded in such a fashion, you're dealt with, and there's generally not a lot of support for that. Now, that article that came out, three-quarters of it is based wholly on lies. I mean, it was done by an unscrupulous reporter who thinks that to character assassinate me via made-up statements by some of my former comrades, would be to vindicate himself in an article that he wrote about how the majority of veterans are malingerers, which is such a dishonorable and shameful statement, because the majority are not malingerers. The majority are people who are wounded, largely invisibly so, and they deserve the help that they need.
And Captain Montalvan, I'm very sorry, but it's, yeah. we're going to have to break it off now. We are out of time.
Sure.
But I do want to invite people to go to our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. We'll have a link there to the event that you'll be speaking at Parkland College later this month. We've been talking with Luis Carlos Montalvan. He is the author of Until Tuesday, writing about how his service dog, Tuesday, helped him recover from PTSD. And this is Focus on WYLL. And this week on Focus, we're doing something special to honor our veterans. University Laboratory High School, in collaboration with WYLL, has produced an hour-long documentary featuring the stories and struggles of several veterans here in Central Illinois. That program, From the Front Lines to the Home Front, Inside Views of the Military, 1940 to 2012, will air in this time slot next Monday, Veterans Day, and again on Saturday, November 9th at 6 p.m. And all this week on Focus, we'll be running The Changing Military. That's a five-part series on veterans, also produced as a part of the Uni High Project. Right now, I want to welcome two people who worked on the documentary. Dave Dickey is WILL's agricultural director, and he also coaches the Uni High students who put the documentary together. And Sanjay Koshy, who worked on the Uni High Veterans documentaries, he's now a graduate of Uni High and a freshman at the University of California at Berkeley, from where he joins us on the phone. Hello, Sanjay.
Hello.
And hello, Dave.
Good morning, Jim. Good to be here.
And tell me about this. This has been an ongoing project for several years, these documentaries produced by kids over at Uni High. How did this get started?
Well, it is kind of a long story, but I think that WILL and both the radio station as well as the TV station has long had an affinity for working with youth. Back in the day, there were TV shows before Mr. Rogers was on where we did shows with children. About the time that I came to the radio station in the mid-80s, we were doing a show called Treehouse Radio, where children are heard but not seen. And so we've had this long established relationship with working with children. And out of that, about the early to mid-90s, Dan Simeone, who was the station manager at the time, had a relationship with Jeremy Hobson. Now, that's a name that will be familiar with many who are public radio listeners, because he is a co-host of the noon show that we carry here called Here and Now. Well, he got his start here with station manager Dan Simeone, and they did a show together on Holocaust survivors. And I got drug into this process because about that same time, we got our first digital platform called the SAW. And I was the one at the radio station that played with the SAW the most and knew something about how it worked. And I taught Dan how to use the SAW. And then he, in turn, taught Jeremy how to use the SAW in the development of the short piece on Holocaust survivors. Later on, Dan reached out to University Laboratory High School to Barb Wasaki, who was on the faculty there, and they got the idea that maybe we could do a little bit more. And out of that effort became the hour-long documentary. Now, over the years, we've added many other things, including this week-long series, and as well as a community event that's going to be on November the 14th.
Well, how do you pick the topics each year for these documentaries?
Well, the students have a lot of input in it. Every summer, Janet Morford, who is the current faculty member over at University Laboratory High School, who works with the students most directly, brainstorms with what will become the senior leadership team about topic possibilities. And out of those discussions will come three or four topics that might be of interest. And then they try to narrow it. And some of the criteria for narrowing the topics are, one, will it be of interest to WILL listeners? And two, is it doable? Are there enough voices in East Central Illinois that we can bring into the radio station on a particular topic in order to get enough material together to do a documentary? For example, a number of years ago, we kind of wanted to maybe do Negro League baseball players, but we couldn't do the topic because we couldn't find enough people. So there is a practical concern as well as an editorial concern.
Well, how did you come to pick veterans, not veterans, but the military over really the last 60 or so years for this year's documentary?
Well, Sanjay might be able to answer that a little better.
Sanjay, tell me about the process. How did you come across this topic?
Well, you always see in the newspaper stories about wars overseas, about soldiers killed, and I felt like the topic of veterans is really a pertinent and current topic, so a lot of people would be interested in it. And I felt that although it is in the news a lot, most of the news articles are just like statistics. about, oh, this many people died, or we managed to capture this base. And I felt like the life of the military could use a bit more explanation. Like, I felt that people need to see more of the human side of war rather than just the statistics or the tactics or the politics behind the military and war.
Using that as a starting point, how did you find the veterans that you spoke to for this program?
Well, we looked into local organizations. We asked if our interns had any family or friend connections to the military. We also looked at the university. So in regards to the university, we looked at, for example, the Veterans Student Support Services, the Disabilities Resources and Educational Services. So that allowed us to get a lot more information and resources about possible interviewees. And then as far as the local organizations, we looked into the Office of the Illinois National Guard. We also looked at the organization Vietnam Veterans Against the War to see if there were any members who would be willing to talk to us about their experiences.
Dave, as sort of the coach in this project, tell me, are the students doing most of the work in finding the people and crafting the interviews?
Students do all the work. They do the work from the development of the idea to finding the people, to developing the question lists, to doing the interviews, to producing the documentary and short series afterwards. So to writing the scripts for all of those things. So my part of it is sort of as teacher to teach them how to do it. But all the editorial material that you will hear on the air, on the radio, is actually their work.
Sanjay, I was wondering, because I know when folks listen to the documentary and through the series we're airing this week on Focus, when they hear the program, I think they'll notice really a clear thematic structure of various subjects, the different wars. The changes from the draft to the volunteer army, the challenges faced by African American women and gays and lesbians. Were these themes that you brought to the program and were asking people about, or is it what the veterans were telling you?
Yes, definitely. Especially since we interviewed women in the military, racial minorities in the military, LGBT in the military. Their experience was very much defined by either their sexual orientation or their racial background or their gender. So bringing these topics to light was very important since these issues are central to the our interviewees' experiences.
Well, was there anything particular that you found out from talking with these veterans that you didn't know?
I'd always thought of the military as a uniform body. I never realized how vastly different people's experiences, their opinions, their feelings about the military can be. There's a positive and negative. So one of the main things I learned, I'd say, is how the military isn't just this one giant body, but it's in fact made up of a large amount of perspectives and experiences.
Now, in a moment, we're about to hear the first of the short segments, which will run throughout this week. The one-hour documentary will be running in the Focus time slot on Monday. What can we expect to hear? Is there particular differences between these short features and Monday's documentary?
Oh yeah. So these short pieces, these radio spots, are intended to have a much smaller focus than the actual documentary. We want to focus on specific topics which we found had a lot of material, but maybe not all made it into the final documentary. Specifically, the topics covered will be, one, reasons for joining the military, specifically during the last two decades; two, the racial desegregation of the military; 3, anti-war activism during the Vietnam War, 4, the experiences of women in the military, and finally, the experiences of LGBT personnel in the military.
Okay. How many students worked on, all told, how many students worked on this documentary project?
About 20 or 30, including the students who first interviewed these people, to the people who did background research, to the people who edited. Yes, I'd say about 30 people.
And that would be the number of people that did it after the interviews actually occurred. It actually involves like the entire sub-freshman class at University Laboratory High School each year, which runs somewhere between 60 and 70 students. It's an outgrowth of one of the classes that's taught over there.
And Dave, I'm wondering, besides coaching this project, you're a Marine veteran yourself, so you must bring us your own point of view to this. What did you learn from working on this project?
Well, my mother was a candy striper in World War II and worked at a local hospital, and that's actually how she met my father, who had some serious injuries after fighting in Okinawa. And so I was personally fascinated by some of the parts about women in the military, particularly about the WAVES and their involvement in the military.
Okay, that was something that really had a personal connection
yes.
for you. At this point in time, do we know what next year's project is going to be?
We do. It is a project that deals with looking at intellectual disabilities.
Okay. Well, Dave and Sanjay Koshy, I wanted to thank you both for talking with me today about these documentary projects from Uni High. The one-hour documentary will be running Monday in this time slot on Veterans Day, and again Saturday, November 9th at 6 p.m. You can hear the short features all this week on Focus and on Morning Edition. And the first one comes to us right now.
Students from University Laboratory High School in Urbana interviewed former U.S. servicemen and women to learn about their attitudes toward the military. All this week, we will hear their stories. Today, in part one of The Changing Military, we listen to some reasons people have joined the services since enlistment became voluntary. Series producer Sanjay Koshy narrates the story written by Uni High student Sherry Q.
With the end of the Vietnam War, the military became an all-volunteer force. Since then, young men and women from Central Illinois who volunteered have done so for various reasons. Some, like former Coast Guard officer Nicholas Osborne, saw the military as a gateway to adulthood, full of adventure and excitement.
As I got older, being 16, 17, I felt like there was this need to go through a test. And I felt like our culture is a culture where we don't really have a lot of formal rites of passage for young people to kind of transition into adulthood. And I looked at the military as sort of an entry point into going through that transition. I liked the service aspect, knowing that there is a service component to it. And I liked that there was adventure, traveling around and having experiences that just sounded very exciting.
For Chad Garland, who served in the Marine Corps, a childhood fascination with fighter jets drew him to military service.
I had gone to air shows when I was younger. We used to go up to Rockford, Illinois, to the air show there. And I had seen Harrier jets. They're jets, but they can take off straight up. Jets cool. push down, and then they take off. And I thought those were really cool, and I'd want to fly one of those. And at the time, the Marine Corps was the only service that flew those in the U.S. And so I went and talked to the Marines, and I said, what do I need to do to fly a jet?
Service members often play a key role in letting young people know about the kinds of opportunities that the military offers. Former Navy officer Joseph Rank encourages young people who are considering enlisting.
I say go for it and make the most of every opportunity that's presented to you. When you're 18 or 21, you think that 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years is forever. And so a lot of times you're afraid to make a commitment because, I'll be an old man by the time it goes very quickly, okay? And there are certain opportunities that come along at certain points in your life, and if you don't take them, you're too old.
Despite having different reasons for joining the military, those who serve generally agree that they have been transformed by their experiences. I'm Sanjay Koshy.
And I will always do my duty, no matter what the price. I've counted up the cost.
And that's wrapping up Focus for today on WILL. We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. Well, likely the first result on your search engine under WILL Focus. Today's show produced by Lindsay Moon. Jason Croft is our technical director. Sari Lesk is our intern, helping with production and research. Tomorrow on Focus, as well as our continuing segment on veterans in the region, as the city of Champaign readies new rules allowing the keeping of chickens, hens only, in backyards, we'll learn more about the world of urban chicken farming. That's coming up on tomorrow's program. Remember, Focus is live each weekday morning at 10 with a replay at 8 p.m. You can hear Focus over the air on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen to past programs and sign up for our free podcast. That's will.illinois.edu/focus. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.